Doug Woodring and Karen Malmstrom talking about capturing the plastic vortex on the 10th. Then Barry Chung from the Mercantile Exchange, right, talking about China's commodities trading boom. That one is selling well, I believe. So if you're interested, please do sign up on the 11th of November. And Sophie Richardson from Human Rights Watch talking about China's black jails on the 12th of November. Karen Razlan is a columnist, a business consultant, and he is, I believe, like myself, a proud Malaysian. He splits his time now mainly between Kuala Lumpur and Jakarta, but he also knows the rest of Southeast Asia very well, Thailand, the Philippines. He's written columns for a number of regional publications for some time. But he actually began his career as a lawyer, and in fact he began his career as a lawyer in a very famous Malaysian law firm working with Hishamuddin Hussein, who is now Malaysia's Home Minister. So it goes without saying he's a very well-read, a very thoughtful, and a very well-connected observer of Malaysian affairs. And he's asked me to mention, has a great interest in Indonesia as well, and is very interested to take questions on race and religion in Indonesia as well, if that's your interest as well. Without further ado, can I give the floor to Karen?
Okay, thanks Doug, thanks Colm, Tom and John. Thanks also to the FCC for having me. I fully understand Malaysia, a very small country, and would take a very tiny slice of interest of anyone in Hong Kong, what with the giant surrounding you. And because of that, I actually suggested at the time that maybe I should talk about Indonesia. So, and I do stress that, I actually shuttle 50-50 between the two countries. So for me, and there is a lot that I have learned about my own country because of the time I spent in Indonesia. And I covered the elections recently quite thoroughly. Though being a weekly columnist and not a news journalist, I suppose my take on things is always going to be slightly different and slightly more impressionistic and episodic. Anyhow, without further ado, let me just rattle into my presentation. Malaysia, race and religion in a rapidly growing Southeast Asia. My core argument, and I'll be coming back to this again and again, is very simple. That Malaysia needs fundamental reform of two areas. For those of you who don't know, Malaysia is a multiracial country, 50% Malay Muslim, maybe 55%, 30% ethnic Chinese, and 10% Indian. Hindu predominantly. So the racial complexion is central to the country's identity as well as its core hurdle politically and economically. So racial policies need to be addressed. Since 1969, major race riots, the country has had a policy of racial positive discrimination to the majority Malay Muslim community. And I am from that community by dint of the fact my father is Malay, or was Malay, father's passed away, my mother is English. So that's a core issue that remains untackled. The second core issue is our civil liberties agenda. Now, many Malaysians, especially those, many friends in government would say, Malaysia cannot have a more open civil liberties, a more open freedom of the media, freedom of assembly, because of the racial divide. We can't trust ordinary Malaysians in such a potentially volatile mix. That's why we must have all these curbs. We must have newspapers which are given licenses on a yearly basis. So the two are very interconnected in the mindset of the Malaysian elite. And notwithstanding recent events, this has become even more hardened. So for me, someone who spends a lot of time in Indonesia, a country that has experienced the Big Bang in terms of civil and political liberties, I very much oppose this view. And this is quite well known in Malaysia. So I always try my best to say, look, we've got to liberalize, and actually the Malaysian people, we've educated, we've given them so much choice in terms of commercial choices, can put up with the freedom and will act with far greater wisdom and sense than many would understand and many would appreciate. The ones who will not act with the same degree of good sense and also perhaps responsibility are often our political leaders and those in the political elite, sadly. So, to my mind, these are two critical issues, and they impact on the economy and the economic future for Malaysia, because our small country of only 25 million people has neither the enormous market of a China, an India, a Brazil, or Indonesia to attract that type of investment, nor does it have the enormous degree of natural resources that these large countries have, or countries with significant oil and gas mineral resources as such. The unique selling proposition for Malaysia going forward is very much like the truly Malaysia, truly Asia tourism tagline. It is something which is promoted internationally and sadly, to a large extent, is not really deeply rooted in the Malaysian polity. We live lives in silos, Malay, Indian, and Chinese. And this is something that we have to get over. And we will not be able to get over it until we tackle these things more firmly. So, I should also explain why I feel this so strongly and why the work that I do as a columnist kind of reinforces this. As I said, as Doug has said, I am both a columnist and a consultant. But what I am perhaps better known for in Malaysia is as a columnist. I write column in English in a newspaper called The Star. It's the largest English language daily, a massive Bible of a newspaper. If it were to drop on your head, it could kill you. There is so much advertising in it. great, at least it pays for me. Not very much, but it pays me something. Then the same column is translated into Malay, which is the language of the majority population, and is run in a newspaper called Sinar Harian, and the same column again is translated into Chinese into a newspaper called Sinchu Daily, which is actually has the same shareholder as a very dignified, very well-known newspaper here, Ming Pao. Interestingly, the newspaper with the largest circulation is not a Malay language daily, it's actually a Chinese language daily, Sinchu. So you can imagine Sinchu in a community which has felt quite embattled, has preserved the cultural and linguistic traditions of an overseas Chinese population, and they feel very strongly about this. So for me, it's been an enormous privilege to contribute to this paper and actually to get a sense of this very dignified, very deeply cultured kind of Nanyang Chinese tradition. And the newspaper, all three newspapers have been very good to me, but Sinchu in particular has published my books and has often taken me on book tours through Chinese Malaysia, which has been, you know, very much an eye-opener for myself. So because of this, I've always felt I have to write for middle Malaysia, notwithstanding the fact that, frankly, I come from very much an elite background. I feel I have to write in a way which connects with ordinary Joes, Amats, Chongs, and Ramasamis, because that's who reads my column. And at the same time, one thing I've also realized is that it's very easy to use racially kind of charged epithets or racially charged arguments when you write in one silo, in English or Malay or Chinese. But when you're writing across the board, you write for the whole country, and you've really got to think through the subtleties of what you're saying and how you present yourself and how you present your arguments. So it's because of that I've become increasingly focused on this, and the idea that we have to work together, and albeit somehow cutting across these silos. Sadly, at the moment, I think I'm still the only person who writes regularly, well, every week, across all three languages and is published. And the other thing to add to that is, since June, I've also been writing for a very fine publication in Jakarta called the Jakarta Globe, English language newspaper. I think guys around here will know some of the people who set the paper up, Lynn Newman, Joe Cochran and all. And that's also been absolutely fascinating. Malaysia, Indonesia, very similar. But what I realize is that What I write for Malaysia has absolutely no interest or traction in Jakarta. So it's forced me to do something totally different. But it shows that, you know, neighbors, but totally different. Even though we speak the same language, the majority language is Malay. In Indonesia, it's called Indonesian, but the root is Malay. Politically and historically, we're totally different. So let me quickly rattle through a kind of quick run through the past 24 months and how this reinforces my view that we've got to get back in Malaysia, policymakers have got to get back to the issue of addressing these racial special privileges for the Malay community, creating a much more equitable landscape, and then dealing with civil liberties, and how that will, I feel, positively impact on the economy and the economic prospects for Malaysia going forward. The most notable event last year, obviously, was our general election back in March, in which the opposition alliance led by Anwar Ibrahim surprised everyone, myself included. I can remember lying on my couch at home thinking, gosh, I'm going to be flying down to Jakarta first thing the next morning, because I didn't think there was going to be anything interesting in the result, only to get calls from friends of mine who just lost their seats, saying, you know, Karim, it's a swing, you know, we may all be out of government. And then realizing how everything had changed. Sadly, the promise that he brought in with him, he's in many ways failed to deliver. Anwar is perhaps the smoothest, the most glittering of political players ever to have emerged from Southeast Asia. He is the most charming. He is the most adept and the most persuasive. But sadly, he did not devote enough energy in the past 18 months to building an alliance, the alliance amongst this disparate group, his own party, a group of kind of refuseniks from the government, the Chinese Socialist Party, the DAP, and the Muslim Islamicists. A very strange bunch. When all is said and done. But sadly, Anwar, who could have straddled them all, did not spend enough time actually building the sinews across this group. And in a way, the fact now that they are beginning to fall apart is, I'm afraid to say, a reflection of his failure to invest the time and energy where it was required on the ground. And I remember interviewing him nearly a year ago, and my conclusion was, please, for God's sake, spend more time with the troops. Do not talk about trying to topple the government. Build an alternative force to the Barisan Nasional, which has ruled in Malaysia for over 50 years, so at least the guys in government are going to get a really solid competitor. And that has been his failure. Thereafter, the March elections, we had the Prime Minister at the time, Abdullah Badawi, very charming man, very decent man, but sadly not a man with the ability to grasp the full complexity of what modern day government requires. And he was totally snowed under. And because he came, you know, after 50 years of running Malaysia, UMNO and Barisan, they only had one way of looking at the country. And when they suffered this massive loss of face and loss of seats, he could not adjust. So in a way, he had to go, and he did go, and was replaced in April by Najib Razak. Now, I'm not close in any way to Najib Razak, and I don't think he likes me whatsoever, but one thing I'll say for him is he's a very smart man. This is a man who's very widely read, very calm, very strategic, and can digest multiple agendas at the same time. So in many ways, you've got someone now who's been in office since April, who's actually slowly pulling together. He's very aware of what I would say are the two major challenges facing Malaysia. But as a politician, I'm an outsider, I'm a columnist. It's my role to say these things. But he's the one who has to implement. I can see his view is the racial divide, I will not touch. I won't be able to manage it. Civil liberties, he doesn't believe in civil liberties too much anyhow. You know, we maintain what we have, we don't go beyond that. But he will work through a better implementation of policies that do exist and work on the incentives so that the non-Malays and the minorities feel that the situation is fairer. So whilst the underlying core issues will not be addressed, I can see his tact is to work at more, superficial would be unfair, but maybe implementation level and in terms of policies. And because he is a very smart guy and he has enormous experience of governance, he will most likely succeed. This, to such a large extent, is a damning indictment, really, of Anwar Ibrahim's leadership of the opposition. In March last year, he had the chance to create a real, not two-party, because you have these two blocks, but he had that opportunity, and he's dropped the ball. And it's an enormous shame, because for people like myself, notwithstanding all my friendships with those in government, they need to be kept honest. They also need to sleep at night with the knowledge, not that they will always be in government, but that they can get kicked out. And because that they can get kicked out, they will have to be more honest, more careful, and more sincere in whatever they do, and that they will be held accountable for their decisions. As long as they feel that they will always be in office, we will be subject to policies and government decision making, which is clearly not going to benefit the ordinary man in the street. So as I said, I feel, and it pains me really to say this, because I would like to see a proper two-block system in Malaysia, where we have, you know, Anwar leading one side, maybe Najib on the other side, and really testing one another and testing and pushing the levels of governance higher. But what we've got is essentially a very ugly spat where it's just trading of insults between the two parties and the two sides. And basically, because Anwar has not been focused on this, and also to be frank, they have really pressed him, you know, very unkindly and very unfairly on all these private privacy issues. He's distracted, I suppose. But notwithstanding that, he's failed to galvanize this group. So we have a situation now where the Islamist party has themselves kind of begun to fracture. Past the Islamist party is actually, there are so many very, very bright young men in the party, it's quite staggering. Because Malaysia's had this tradition of sending very bright young Malay men and women abroad for education. To my amazement, I've discovered that so many of them on their return to Malaysia did not join the ruling UMNO party, they joined PAS. And these are, you know, they're all kind of like PhDs from top Western universities, speak English perfectly, Malay and Arabic. And you get this kind of sinking sense, my God, this is the cream of what Malaysia is producing. And they do not feel comfortable with the secular structure or the quasi-secular structure. They feel more comfortable with the Islamists. So you have, in the Islamist party, you have guys like this, but you also have these dyed-in-the-wool, verging on mad mullahs, quite frankly. Very, very disturbing leaders who have very, very retrogressive views on moral policing, which have actually made much of middle Malaysia deeply disturbed about where the country is going. And it's strange, of course, they are in alliance with the Socialist Chinese Party, which is very much a similar kind of ethos to Lee Kuan Yew's PAP. But they're all strange bedfellows, so be it, as long as they can bring Malaysia to a higher level. Now, with Najib coming in, I think we've seen, and for those of you who are covering the business media space, you'll see a whole spate of initiatives, a whole spate of relaxation and liberalization. This is what he's doing. This has pleased a lot of the predominantly non-Malay foreign business community. He's done well there. He's also done pretty well, actually, addressing one community which felt terribly aggrieved because of the way that majority Malay governments were dealing with their centers of places of worship, Indian community. There was a spate of temple demolitions under Abdullah, not because Abdullah condoned them, but because Abdullah was never really in charge enough to see what this was doing to the social political fabric. And Najib has been much more assiduous in dealing with this. And specifically addressing policies to win over communities. So what he's done is a very piecemeal approach. We need this block of votes, we address them like this. We need this, we address them like this, which is modern politics. But sadly, it does not address the fundamental issue of the racial divide and the civil liberties agenda. I think, I mean, at the risk of kind of repeating myself ad nauseum, I'd say that if an election were to be held quite soon, I suspect actually that Najib Razak would most likely win. There's this very, very charming chap, the chief minister of Penang from the DAP party, Lim Guan Eng, and even he has had to say publicly, I think that Najib Razak would be very, very difficult to remove. And I have to agree with Guan Eng. Najib, notwithstanding all the criticism of him, has just done the job, has focused on building an alliance, albeit there are problems in the alliance parties. Whereas in a way, Anwar got distracted and did not focus on building the sinews amongst the parties and across racial divides and religious divides in the same way. So we may be presented with, and this is a very sad fact, a situation whereby the Barisan will come back, be empowered, and most likely win with an increased majority, and that sense of check and balance will be lost. We've had this opportunity as a country, and we've lost it. And this is a loss for the country more than anything else, because we really need the opposition to succeed, if only to keep those who are in government honest. And I think I'll leave it there, and I'll take questions from the floor. Thanks very much.
Karim, you're welcome to stay at the podium, or we'll come back and sit down for the questions.
Let me sit. Yeah.
Thanks very much, Karim, for that sweeping synopsis of Malaysia's situation. I'm not sure that I totally agree with your political analysis, but I certainly agree with you that the core issues that Malaysia needs to tackle are the questions of civil liberties and race and religion. And I'd like to open the floor and invite anyone who's got questions for you. Could I ask that you identify yourself first if you have any questions? Thank you.
Hello, Tom Holland from the South China Morning Post. Just out of sheer idle interest, you criticise Anwar for not knitting the sinews of a functioning opposition. Even had he done so, would that opposition be a politically viable force? Surely the only thing that PAS has in common with the Socialist Party is opposition to the Barisan Nasional. I mean, even if they were elected, surely that coalition would just fly apart because they've got absolutely nothing in common.
Actually, I disagree. They had quite a lot in common. Remember I was telling you about all these bright young chaps who join PAS, who are like professionals? For them, they see the tenets of the Quran more in terms of the issues of universal issues of fairness, of justice. Now, in that respect, there's a remarkable kind of a mind sync between the socialists in the DAP, who presumably should have those views, and this group in PAS, who, sadly, they were the ones who actually crafted the PAS party election platform last year to tone down the talk about Sharia law, you know, chopping off of hands and all this stuff, and focusing on universal values. And this worked. But this group is very close to Anwar Ibrahim. Sadly, Anwar focused on talking of toppling the government and not of knitting this group more closely together, and also on working with this group to ensure that they defeated the ulama in PAS. So actually, I'd have to disagree. But I mean, there are, from the outside, I also felt the same. But when I spent time with them, I began to realize, shit, they actually have quite a lot in common. And most of these guys represent ordinary people and not entrenched business interests as well. So they resonate on the ground. And that was their strength, and that remains their strength. You know, it's about social justice. It's about the UMNO boys all driving big black sedans and SUVs and having government projects, whereas these boys are all driving these tiny, there's a little Malaysian car, I think it's based on a Daihatsu, called a Kanchil, which is about half the size of this table. And that is the PAS kind of election mobile. You know, they go to elections and campaigning in that. And as soon as somebody turns up in a little Kanchil, you're almost, you win the votes immediately, because it's a sign of humility and relative simplicity. When the guys from the ruling party turn up, they're in very long SUVs, all wearing black and very expensive clothes. People just go, I know where their money comes from. So there is this linkage there, which I felt that they didn't capitalize on.
Tom.
Oh. Yeah, just continuing our line of disputatious questions. I didn't entirely understand your objection to the comments, and I wonder if you would articulate them more clearly and then respond to Douglas's concerns.
No, I just said I didn't totally share some of Karim's characterizations. One thing I would ask you, and that was a wonderful little portrait you've painted of PAS there, and I think that's why you're such a great columnist. From what people I've been talking to in Malaysia tell me, the ruling coalition, the non-Malay parties in the ruling coalition are in absolute disaster, and that is the drag. Even if the Prime Minister Najib has managed to reassert control over UMNO, the Chinese and Indian parties in the multiracial ruling coalition in Malaysia are in a worse state, if anything, than Anwar's opposition. And what people tell me is that PAS, the Islamic Party, will be in power whether with UMNO or with Anwar. And again, that comes back a little bit to our topic. But yeah. What are your thoughts on that subject?
Okay. Well, I think if PAS comes into power, definitely people like myself will be emigrating, because recently, in the last, they call it the PAS General Assembly, their Muqtama, the ulama suddenly realized, my God, all these professionals are taking over the party, and you know they are bringing all these horrible non-Muslims in to meet us, and we don't want to waste time with them. And so they focus single-mindedly on winning back the party, which they did, and basically sidelined all these decent pluralist Islamicists. And now we've got the prospect of somebody called Hadi Awang, who fills me with total horror. I mean, these are people who are, you know, straight out of the book. There is no sense that the eternal message of the Quran needs to be thought through in the context of where we live now. Theirs is a total, the reading from the Quran, that is what it is. And I think that is a situation which will be disastrous for Malaysia. So sadly, the professionals, who are very, very capable guys, have lost the political power within the party. And they themselves are actually under the patronage of this extraordinary chief minister from Kelantan called Nick Aziz, who has been running Kelantan for nearly 20 years. He lives like a pauper. Every day he goes out and sweeps his yard, and he's become like a folk hero for all Malaysians, because he's known to be totally clean, number one. And he speaks in kind of cryptic riddles. So it's actually very difficult to know what he's talking about. But for some strange reason, he believes in the agenda set out by the professionals. And he has sided with the professionals against his own class, the ulama. Sadly, he's well into his late 70s or early 80s. If he dies, then this whole adventure with the professionals will disappear. And this is kind of irony. You have an ulama who's leading the fray, but you know, he's so frail, and once he's gone, we're lost. I mean, so for me, if PAS comes to power, it's a terrible day for Malaysia. If PAS, which is now, the PAS which we have now, that's terrible.
Philip.
Philip Bowring. A couple of questions. First of all, on East Malaysia, could you say something about its political role, given the fact that its ethnic and religious composition is very different? And even whether it has a long-term future in as part of Malaysia. Second question is, what does Indonesia have to teach Malaysia, and would Malaysia ever listen?
Yeah, true. Okay. First of all, East Malaysia. We always joke. Actually, I was having lunch with, there's a Sabahan minister in the government, I won't say who, and we were all joking about the fixed deposit. Now, for the Sabahans and Sarawakians, that's the two states in East Malaysia, the north of Borneo, they view themselves as the fixed deposit for the Najib administration. So they have been negotiating very tough with Najib for what they want, more development money, more ministerial posts. And that's how it should be. It's real politics. They should take a lot more, because rural development in Sabah and Sarawak has been very badly dealt with. At the same time, race relations in East Malaysia far, far surpass anything that exists in West Malaysia. There's a much more easy engagement across racial and religious lines. People are not so paranoid and not so hung up in East Malaysia. So it is, in many ways, what we should be in West Malaysia looking to, except nowadays we tend to export our paranoia across the South China Sea. With regard to Indonesia, of course, Malaysians will never listen to what Indonesia has to learn, because sadly, most Malaysians tend to view Indonesians, it's very sad, because the Indonesians we see in Malaysia are maids and workers in plantations and on building sites. We don't see the middle class of professional Indonesians, you know, the like the Sri Mulyanis, all these academics and these professionals. So we don't recognize how far Indonesia has come. And also we don't really see the value of this kind of open, more dynamic public space, and how this open, more dynamic public space can contribute to a greater sense of kind of social stability. There's a, especially with the Malay elite, there's a sense, no, we can't go that direction. Sadly, I don't think we'll ever learn from them. Indonesia, they're a crazy bunch. And, you know, we can't learn from them. We are, the other thing to remember is Malaysia is a kerajaan. The government is called a kerajaan, which is Raja is king, so the government is of the king. In Indonesia, it's pemerintah, it's government, pemerintah to rule, to govern. So in Malaysia, our whole ideas of governance are driven by the court and by a very kind of royal sense, which is why people like Najib Razak, they're from the royal houses in themselves. Their fathers, their grandfathers are descended of people who served in the royal houses as lords. In Indonesia, it's far more republican, far more open, and chaotic for all that.
Jason. Well, there it goes. I wanted to ask you about your take on the incident that happened a couple of months ago, where a woman who was in, I remember exactly where.
Sorry, we'll get you another mic. I think there's a problem with that.
I'm not good at tipping this. She was sentenced to 10 lashes or something like that. The first woman in Malaysia to be sentenced to lashes by the cane in like forever. And her sentence was commuted, but it was this huge, huge flap. And I wondered when I read the reports of it, what's really going on here? Is it that the government is trying to make points with the Islamicists, or is this an isolated case? What's your take on it?
Actually, Pahang is actually where she was caught drinking. Is actually a state which is actually governed by the ruling by the Barisan Nasional, and Najib, the Prime Minister, comes from that state. But I think this is more a reflection of the extent to which the civil service, and especially the Islamic kind of institutions, have taken on a life of their own. They have their own way of dealing with things and viewing things. So I wouldn't say it's necessarily a reflection of a battle between political forces. This is a reflection of the increased conservatism which is across the country. It's embedded and growing. Yeah.
The lady at the front first, and then...
Could I ask you to introduce yourself and your affiliations?
Charmaine Chan, South China Morning Post. I'm curious about whether Malays in general
want to continue indefinitely to be recipients of positive discrimination?
Okay. Very difficult to say. I'm a minority of one, clearly, yeah? And I think my views are kind of out there. But one thing is very clear is that there is, you know, Malaysia is a country in which Islam is the religion of the state. It's not Indonesia, which is a secular state. Therefore, there is a sense that Islam is a religion placed higher than the other religions. So by that, and all Malays are Muslim, the mere fact of that actually places those of one faith above those of another faith, because it is the religion of the state. So this in itself creates all sorts of ways that look of looking both at yourself and your neighbors and other people who are of different religions. So I don't think we're going to be able to move away from that paradigm. There is a sense that Islam is a higher religion in Malaysia than other religions. And that will impact, obviously, on all Malay Muslims, because it's enshrined in the constitution.
Just to quickly interject yeah. there. But the past, the Islamic Party have actually opposed the NEP and the racial affirmation yeah. policies on Islamic principles that Islam is not racist. Yeah. It is not race-based.
But I think this is where, you know, they can say this on the outside, but my reading of my own community is actually that this is very deeply embedded. I mean, you've had decades of education telling you that you are the preferred. It would be very, very difficult to unwind. And that's why I can see when I raise these issues in my own context, I can see them all going, it won't work, it won't fly. But, I mean, as I say, that's my task is to raise them. But I think it would be very, very difficult. Having said that, the country has no choice but to go that direction because we need to create a more level playing field and a sense of equality across the racial divide and religious divide.
Next question is Ernst Herr.
Ernst Herr, I work for Finanzwirtschaft, a Swiss financial newspaper. My question is about the changing external environment on Indonesia, particularly also on Malaysia. On the one hand, the rise of China, the growing economic influence of China. To what degree does that empower the Chinese community in both of these places? Particularly good of in Malaysia, but on the other hand, yesterday we had Jane Perlis here from the New York Times, who talked about is Pakistan lost? To what degree does the kind of this problem in the Middle East, particularly also in Pakistan and Afghanistan, affecting the discourse of the Muslim community in both of these places?
Okay, I think you've had I think you've happed on a very core trend and a very core kind of geopolitical theme. Malaysia's new economic policy, the kind of the economic angle of the privileges for the Malay community was really crafted in the early 70s at a time when China was recovering from Cultural Revolution. India was deeply kind of inward looking with Nehru socialism. So those days have gone. You're looking at a China now which looks out. In fact, I think next week somebody was telling me Hu Jintao is descending with something like 4 or 5 private jets before he visits Singapore. And the fact is we have to engage as a country with the new giants. And the new giants will inevitably consider their first interlocutors as those who share the same culture and language. There are so many Malaysian tycoons who have, shall we say, stronger relationships with Beijing even than the Malaysian government themselves. You know, that goes without saying. And how they view Malaysian government will most likely matter a lot more. And the same will be the case with India. So the geopolitical environment is the thing that actually is prompting me to be the Cassandra, which is we must change before we are changed by the forces outside. Number one. So you're entirely right. Totally agree with you there. I think I've forgotten the second question now. Sorry. Oh, Pakistan. No, I don't think we're on the verge of a kind of meltdown a la Pakistan. there is, you know, if you go across Malaysia, there is an extent, a degree to which ordinary Malaysians of all races have benefited from the economic growth. Though there are substantial, they say the Gini coefficients are quite large. You've got, you know, electricity, water, schools across the country. But people now are more concerned with relative opportunities. Why does that guy who is a member of the political party, the ruling elite, get a contract when I get nothing? So there is that sense there. But they've all got the basics. So we are nowhere like the Middle East. We are nowhere like Pakistan. But conservatism is a fact of life. I always say, I'm not a particularly observant Muslim, but I always say that religious observance in itself is no bad thing. It, you know, discipline, a greater sense of stronger families or whatever, and people are free to do that. It's when people choose to impose that on others, that's when problems happen. And in a way, now we are verging on that. Coming back to your question earlier, you know, the observance now is coming to the point people want to impose it on others. I think there's a question, a gentleman down the front.
I think it's probably going to have to be the one of the last questions here at the front.
Okay. My name is Balakrishnan. I'm just wondering whether, you know, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I'm Balakrishnan. I'm just wondering whether, you know, you're looking for political change via two-party system may be a bit misplaced. If you look at, I lived in Malaysia for a long time, and you look.
Yeah,
if you look at the history of UMNO, it has always reinvented itself from within. You know, even Anwar, in a way, is an intra-UMNO force. And UMNO became Barisan National. Now the ideas are being floated around about turning Barisan National into a multiracial party, a direct membership, which again is not a new idea. I think it was floated under Tunku and Kill. That's that's one question. The other question is, even though Malaysia may not stand a good... Malaysia may not stand a good comparison if you look, say, past 10 years with Indonesia. But you look at a little bit longer, Malays have been very pragmatic people, you know. They avoided any kind of extreme policies, the confrontacy, or joined the Americans in the Vietnam War. My feeling is the Malay elite is a very pragmatic one and adjusts itself accordingly as China rises.
Okay. I think, yeah, BN has an ability to change. The government has an ability to change. That's also partly with the fact because the party is itself has no... There is no great kind of guiding principle except for survival and survival of the elite themselves and the way, you know, people like myself. So, yeah, they will change. They will cope. But the changes that they are putting in place are not as fundamental as people like myself say that they need in order to take the country further forward. And that's where I would say, and I mean, I know they're gonna say, yeah, we have great relations with, you know, PRC, with Beijing, but I think we'll find that Beijing will be much, much more interested in the opportunities that come from a country like Indonesia than they will be from Malaysia. Bigger market, more natural resources. So we have to make ourselves more attractive as a smaller country in order to attract that type of investment.
Just one final question from the table, Colm.
You mentioned earlier that Najib policies does not address the fundamental issues, but at the same time you said that there won't be a meltdown a la Pakistan. So how do you see Malaysia in 5 years from now? I mean, how is this going to be resolved 5 years, 10 years down the line?
I don't think it will be resolved. I suspect we will muddle through because we, as you say, the party that is in power now is very adaptive. So they will adapt to the situation, but this core tenet, which is the kind of supremacy of the Malays, is something which they will not want to give up. And I think that's something fundamental that has to be given up. I suspect economically we may not find a very clear path forward because we're caught in this kind of middle-income, middle-sized country trap. Not nimble enough like the Singapores of this world, or perhaps not attractive enough like the big giants. So I feel that, and then the external scenario that you're talking about with the rise of China and India is going to become much, much more important. So I feel that these forces are coming in on us, so we may not have so much time domestically to cope. that's why I'm saying we must address them before they are forced upon us by external factors.
Okay, with that, I think I'd like to thank Karen very, very much for his talk. I think we, speaking personally, and I think as much of this audience as I know, all wish him all the best in persuading the powers that be in Malaysia of the wisdom of his proposals. He's far too worldly, of course, to be to come across as being optimistic for change in Malaysia. But I will have you know that his latest collection of columns is called A Dream Deferred, and I do know that he is a dreamer. Karen Razlan, thank you very much indeed, and thank you for coming.